upward. Three Finnish ferries have now been found to have faulty hydraulic doors. A ship equipped with remote control cameras has set off for the scene of the Estonia disaster. The investigation has been delayed for 2 days because of bad weather. It's hoped that the pictures will be able to prove whether a damaged door was to blame for the ferry going down. Two more Indian states have ordered the closure of schools and colleges because of fears the plague may strike students. Punjab and Haryana states are also worried that students coming from other areas may bring in the infection. Ulster Unionist MP Ken McGuinness and the Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams are to meet in America. They'll take part in a live debate on US TV. Mr. McGuinness says he wants to make sure Mr. Adams isn't given a free run during his publicity tour of the country. London's weather staying dry this morning, but there will be a lot of cloud around. Should brighten up a little this afternoon, though, with temperatures reaching 17 Celsius, 63 Fahrenheit. The next news at 9 o'clock.
Here, I was clearing out the attic when I came across a bag of old cine films. Anyway, a neighbour told me about Black Cat Video, and they transferred them to video for me. They added titles and music and made extra copies, which I gave to the kids as presents. Oh, the memories they brought back. There was Aunt Maureen as a baby. Well, she's got kids of her own now. Another great idea from Black Cat Video. Phone Potter's Bar 6 43000. That's 01707 6 43000.
From October the 5th, will you be listening in black and white or colour?
Troops and vehicles have been moving through this town on the way to the front.
There's no escaping the fact that today we live in a 24-hour world. Hello, I'm John Terrett, with you from 8 every weeknight on London News 97.3 FM. I'll be keeping you ahead of the news, bringing you the latest sports results, and of course, the best roundup of all the day's financial news from the world's markets. All this, plus the fastest travel information and the most accurate weather forecasts on radio.
London News 97.3 FM. All news, all the time.
Sport on the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
Yes, and looking at a 24-hour sports world, here's Johnny Gould. Good morning, sir.
Thanks, Steve. You do script them, don't you?
I do, yes.
Europe's richest racing event, the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe, is run at Longchamp today with strong British representation. One of the best British-backed chances is the filly Only Royale, written by Frankie Dettori. The horse is trained at Newmarket by Luca Camani, who's in confident mood.
I think she won the Yorkshire Oaks this year in an even more emphatic style than she did last year. And it'd be nice to think that she's even better than last year, but we won't know until the day.
Steve Robinson's retained his WBO featherweight title in Cardiff. He beat Croydon's Duke McKenzie after flooring his rival in the ninth round with a stunning body punch. It's a defeat that's likely to bring to an end McKenzie's 41-fight career. Last night he'd hoped to become the first fighter to win world titles at four different weights. Three London sides compete for Premiership points this afternoon. Chelsea, fresh from European Cup Winners' Cup success over Viktoria Shishkov, meet West Ham at Stamford Bridge. And at the City Ground, Queen's Park Rangers face a tricky fixture with Nottingham Forest. A win for the East Midlanders would lift them to within 2 points of Newcastle. Indeed, it was the Toon Army who kept up the pressure on the chasing pack yesterday with a 2-0 victory at Aston Villa. No joy for Blackburn Rovers, who lost ground with a 2-1 defeat at Norwich. It all started so brightly, though, for Rovers, as their £5 million star Chris Sutton scored against his old club in the opening 4 minutes. In London, John Sulaco scored twice as Crystal Palace beat Arsenal 2-1. And Ozzie Ardiles' fortunes are improving again. Three straight defeats were turned round, a 2-1 win at Wimbledon. In rugby union, defending champions Bath are still leading National League One following their 15-10 defeat of Gloucester. Harlequins back on track with a convincing win over West Hartlepool in the Heineken match of the day. Meanwhile, 4,200 runners go to the post. What? For this morning's Bupa Great Caledonian Run in Edinburgh, Hertfordshire's Gary Staines aims to retain his title. And there's a class women's field too, led by Rosa Mota. From Edinburgh, here's Ian Wilson.
Final preparations are underway for some of the world's top class runners who are lining up in Edinburgh for the Bupa Great Caledonian Run. It's truly an international event with such names as Oleg Stryshakov of Russia, John Tracy of Ireland, and last year's winner Gary Staines from Belgrave Harriers, pounding the streets of Scotland's capital city. In the women's race, the hot favourite is Olga Bondarenko, the 1988 Olympic 10,000 metres gold medalist. The 10 kilometres run gets underway very shortly at 9:15, with TV personality Mr. Motivator leading the 4,000-strong field on the run.
And defending champion Scott Russell hopes to make an impact in today's ultimate round of the World Superbike Championships at Donington. The American shattered the course record in practice with championship leader Carl Fogarty second fastest. That is the sport this morning, Steve.
Carl Ruddle, you can't wait for 12 o'clock for them to take the towels off, can you? Really?
I can't. No, I'll crack up my teeth there.
The Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe, my mate goes for King's Theatre in that one really? Today, actually, not only a while. I think that's because he once came to see me in pantomime at the King's Theatre and thought I was very good as a comic policeman.
Is that right? Hey, nice plug.
It's a speciality of mine, that. Niarco Bay was third for us yesterday in the 3-10 at Chepstow, but I'm sorry to say that co-favourite Ringmaster... It was not there in the big one in the Cambridgeshire, the William Hill one yesterday.
But of course your tipster always says, sticking each way on all his...
yes, he does. Actually, come to think of it, I think Ringmaster must have been, because it was a huge field in the William Hill Cambridgeshire.
Well, I was just thinking, each way fifth of the odds there in a big 30-horse field or whatever.
Yes, could be. Yeah. I'd better double check on this.
I think you'd better. Don't rip up that slip yet, Steve.
I certainly won't, Johnny.
Just don't do it.
I'd see you in an hour, mate.
See you later.
Thank you very much. It's 32 minutes, 23 minutes to 9. 23 minutes to 9, and this is LBC. And, a commercial now. Thank you.
That's nice.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
my.
That's nice.
Now, Sunday Telegraph readers can lead more colourful lives.
Oh, that's lovely. That's nice.
Each issue has a coupon worth 50p off any one of a range of leading colour magazines. Vogue, House and Garden, Tatler, The World of Interiors, GQ, Vanity Fair, and The Spectator. The Sunday Telegraph. The Sunday that comes with a choice of colour.
This is the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
It is here on LBC, the Voice of London. Well, how does the world look this morning? Better or worse than it did when we began this programme? In its second run, in fact, 4 or 5 years ago, well, week after week, we've looked at all the disasters going on. So it's a good moment to take stock today and see where we've got to. And with me in the studio to draw up a balance sheet and look at the future is our great judge. Who better to look at this than our diplomatic correspondent, David Spandy. Good morning to you, David.
Good morning, Steve.
So let's look around the world from fashionable West Kensington here. It is hard to believe, but I think it really is in better shape than when we started, isn't it?
I think it's in much better shape. You know, there's so many disasters going on and one mustn't minimise them. But the fact is, there's been a lot of progress, not exactly in human nature, but in the way that human beings address their international problems. And I suppose one would pick, as the example of all that, the increasing use of the United Nations.
Yes, because we spoke about a great change in the United Nations, I suppose particularly when Mr. Boutros-Boutros Ghali took over there.
I think a sense came over the world that, after all, it's better to use the UN and have international cooperation than for countries to go it on their own. There's a certain fiction in this, because you can see in Haiti that it is really the United States going on its own, although they've cobbled together international support. But the very fact they want to do that points to the larger issue, that people do believe now in international affairs to try and get cooperation. Of course, the UN is very weak, hasn't got enough money, hasn't got enough men, hasn't got any resources of its own. And I suppose if you were a man on Mars, standing looking down at the Earth, you'd say, well, there's not much going on there. But when they take a view in 50 years' time and look back at the end of this century, people will say, well, that's the beginning of when mankind started to cooperate, not just on all the other problems we failed to solve, but the sense underlying that, but this is the way forward to deal with international affairs.
So not a changing, really, of human nature, but maybe a more realistic attitude towards our problems, too. And the major area one has to look at, I suppose, is, well, the Middle East.
Well, I'm certainly very hopeful of a peace in the Middle East. I think everyone can see that it's happening now. Of course, there'll be a lot of slip-ups on the way, and one doesn't quite feel certain that Yasser Arafat's going to make it. I mean, he hasn't shown much sign yet of getting a grip of the administration in Jericho and showing that he's really capable of handling what is actually only a small town. But still, he's there in place, and if elections follow, there'll be a new Palestinian leadership and a new generation coming through. And everyone is talking in the Middle East now of peace. I mean, there's peace with Jordan. Syria is coming on track soon. There's a sense that the area would be very successful and prosperous, and why not?
And, of course, this very day, President Mandela arrives in the United States for a week's visit. President Mandela, when you and I started, he was in jail.
This is another, an extraordinary breakthrough. I suppose the most unpredictable of all the things that we've talked about, that he would be come out of jail, emerge as president of the country, and that the country would move peacefully to the end of apartheid. It shows that you could never take anything for granted. Even the very worst predictions sometimes turn, fortunately, wrong in international affairs. And I suppose, again, the man from Mars looking at this would say, well, human beings have their terrible racial hatreds and tensions, but sometimes they're capable of rising above all this in the common interest of getting a stable country. And it's happened in South Africa, and it may well happen elsewhere, because Mandela's success in Africa is a tremendous encouragement and beacon to all the other countries, which I'm sorry to say, virtually all of them, are struggling still to find their independence and their feet.
Yes, indeed. Of course, Patrick Keatley touched on this in his piece this morning, that the majority of the problems that we have don't seem, well, they are no longer of a political dogma problem. It is to do with ethnic and tribal background, isn't it?
Yeah. The end of the Cold War, which was the other big event in the years in which we've been doing the programme, when the Berlin Wall came down and Eastern Europe was liberated, and then the old Soviet leadership was replaced by this rather go-go modern Russian leadership, you know, toasting the success of Boris's trip to the United States so much.
The vodka supremacy.
He didn't feel inclined to get out of the aeroplane. But anyway, these huge, huge changes have led to the tremendous success for the world that we don't really face, touch wood, nuclear war anymore, in the sense of the major superpowers fighting each other. That is an enormous triumph for diplomacy. But it has been replaced by something which is much harder to control in its way, which is the spread of little ethnic and racial and tribal tensions. I mean, Bosnia is only one among many tribal tensions around the world, where people dispute borders and territories and have ancient hatreds which are fan up. And in that situation, I think anyone knows how to deal with it. The UN is too big, the feelings are too strong, and no one can control what's going on. And one day, alas, someone may get nuclear weapons and use them in that sort of conflict.
It's a lot longer ago than 4 years, of course, when Britain was a true superpower in the world. Where do we stand now, do you think, diplomatically, with all the chopping and changing that's been
going
on?
Well, we're a medium-sized European power with everything, as they say in sport, to play for. I think the realisation has come over the British public as a whole. That's where we stand. You know, we talk about the Commonwealth, which is a fine concept. It doesn't actually mean anything in political terms. We feel very fond of the United States and talk about the special relationship, but everybody knows that's over, and in fact the United States regards Germany as more important. But we have found our place in Europe. It's difficult for all the British to accept this because it means giving up some things. You know, the idea of our complete independence to do what we want doesn't exist in the modern world anymore. And some people, especially in the right-wing Conservative Party, don't like that. It'd be interesting to see what the Labour conference says this week about Europe. So I see that Britain emerging, taking a rather rosy view, emerging as a very successful economy and a very successful middle-range power in the most important trade bloc in the world.
Yes, I mean, it seems to me that Mrs. Thatcher used to sort of not dilute things, she used to encapsulate things as seeing world problems and domestic problems as on a one-to-one basis, like running the old grocery shop. And there's something in that, isn't there, in that when one country begins to get into negotiations with another one, it's like going into any relationship, that you gain certain things, but you also give up certain freedoms. That is part of negotiation, surely.
Well, it's very like marriage, you know. It's give and take. You gain certain things and you lose certain bits of independence, but you share something which you didn't get before, which is what the community gives us. Well, I was just looking before I came into the studio at the my screen, you know, of international events this morning, the world as it was at 6 o'clock this morning. And the first item on the screen, not surprisingly, is the plague in India. I think that underlines a point, which is that no matter how ingenious we are in our international relations and all the rest of it, it's really the natural disasters and the natural events of this world which are going to dominate things. You can't predict a plague will happen, and it's an ancient plague. It's something which we've went through the Black Death in the 13th century. Here it's resurfaced again. And I think it shows that we live in a very fragile world, and that unless the mankind can also master the environmental problems that we face, the world won't be living worth living in anyway.
David, thank you for joining us this morning, and of course for all the contributions to this programme over the years. The one big disaster, of course, which will befall you is if they close the casinos in Las Vegas, wouldn't it, really?
Well, Steve,
that will be the end of it for you.
There's always going to be casinos, especially here in London. But I've been going around the office trying to sort of get a testimonial for your departure.
Oh, yes, thank you.
Trying to whip them in. Everyone's tremendously anxious to contribute, actually.
Were they?
Yeah, but they'd seem to have all left their chequebooks at home, and no one's got any spare change Sunday morning.
No great shame.
And the general consensus is you'll go far, but you'll be back.
I will. I surely will. You saw me carrying the waste bin out earlier, didn't you?
It was full of empty champagne bottles.
They were Steve Allen's. They were not mine, I have to tell you. David, thank you very much for all of that. It's now 8:45, and we're going to meet Richard Robbins in a moment, who's going to bring us this month's review of classical music on CD. And before we speak, let's have a touch of the 1812 Overture. Tchaikovsky wrote it, of course. He died 101 years ago. It was the 1812 Overture of the Berlin Philharmonic conductor Herbert von Karajan, and Richard von Robbins is with us.
Very good morning. Yes, well, yes, a highly patriotic original piece there. Tchaikovsky wrote it in a style calculated for popular appeal, and it certainly had that ever since he wrote the thing. I think it was in 1880. It's 100 more, obviously more than 100 years familiar and tremendous performance. I thought, I must say, actually, this morning, I'm acting very heavily under direction, not only from your good self, but also from Gary Donovan, your executive or senior producer, or whatever his status is.
Call him executive, if you'd like.
Well, exactly.
Yes.
But he said, and the last occasion we met was about a month ago, we want the 1812 Overture, we want Alleluia Chorus, we want Land of Overture.
So it's his playlist, really, is it, this morning?
Oh, absolutely. No, all the hits of all time. So there you are. Yes, it was a great piece of music and still is heavily jingoistic and conceived or concerned with Napoleon's battle campaign in Russia and his appalling, catastrophic defeat. Highly emotional and big nationalistic thing. He wrote it for the consecration of the Cathedral of the Redeemer in Moscow, and this was to commemorate, as I say, Russia's victory over Napoleon in 1812, hence the name. But the interesting thing about it is that all these bells and fireworks and cannon and all the rest of it, Tchaikovsky didn't want. I mean, he didn't ask for. These have all been added later.
Yes.
And
It would be a director of some sort, you know.
Oh, sure. Let's sip it up. Let's give it marketing appeal.
That's right. Effects love. Need some effects love, yes, you know.
That's what he said. Let's give it some appeal, you know, to marketing. Yes. So, just as Tchaikovsky just specified, the normal percussion for it, with the use of one big drum, I think. That was about it, sort of big birther of the age, possibly. But it is nonetheless a tremendous performance and hauled out on all these ceremonial occasions, and... Well, sadly, this morning is a very ceremonial occasion.
Indeed it is. Well, that was on the Deutsche Grammophon label. Number two in our hit parade this morning is an RPO disc and a bit of Elgar.
Yes, not so much from the point of view of a great potboiler, although I suppose it is in many ways. It's not dragged out on great big occasions of state. It is one of my... I've popped this in. It's one of my great favourite all-time recordings, certainly of Paul Tortelier, who I knew... rather well. I wouldn't say I sort of palsy-walsy, but very well, in fact. And, it's got a certain spot of autumnal melancholy about it, and I suppose we've got a touch of autumn and maybe even a touch of melancholy about us right now. Elgar wrote it in the latter years of the First World War, And it's, I suppose, he wrote very little during the World War because he felt that Europe had been devastated, the Europe he knew, and he was very, very sad about it all. But anyway, he wrote this, and it was first performed in the following year. Tortelier, I met for his 70th birthday and his 75th birthday, and we did special programmes here on LBC with him. I regarded him as the world's finest cellist, notwithstanding the efforts of Rostropovich and Lloyd Webber and one or two others. But no, he'd made this particular piece a speciality right from his student days when he was awarded a very special prize at the French Conservatoire with it. Okay. Anyway, enough of my chat.
Yes, we'd better play it, I think, because we've got two more pieces to fit in as well. Paul Tortelier is the cellist and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir Charles Groves. Elgar's Cello Concerto, the first movement thereof. Richard Robbins is taking us through four tracks on CD this morning. The next one is on Harmonia Mundi disc.
Yes, indeed. Music of the world, and certainly it is a tremendous piece of music. This, we actually had a little from this disc last month,
right.
The Handel's Messiah. It's a new performance conducted by William Christie, Les Arts Florissants. And as we're now entering the spirit of Christmas season, well, certainly, I mean, in some areas we are.
Well, I think the crackers, the trees, the puddings, they're all out there already, yes, it's true.
Right, so Handel's Messiah is hauled out every Christmas and hauled out every Easter as well. This is, in fact, a new recording. It was out last month, based on the performances, so far as they can be gauged, that actually took place in Handel's lifetime, or towards the end of his lifetime, which was the mid-1700s. How can we say it actually heard. We have a recording here from 1749 or whatever.
Playing this on compact cylinder this morning.
Right. Obviously we don't, but there are such things as programmes, and of course we know the venues, how large the places were, and the instrumentation that was used, and the numbers of people in the choirs. And really, Handel actually arranged all this sort of music for a much smaller group, and this is what we've got in this particular performance. It was only the big groups that arose in the latter part of the 18th and during the 19th century who really whooshed up into these enormous performances. Anyway,
this is a faithful reconstruction of the way it would originally have sounded.
You've said it in one, absolutely. Right. Why don't we hear a bit?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, the Hallelujah Chorus and Les Arts Florissants. The conductor was William Christie. Enjoyed that a lot. And what are you going to take us out with then?
Well, what can we, you know, a tune which, in the words of King Edward the VII, said, well, he told Elgar, if you added words to this, it'll go round the world.
Oh,
and
that?
Of course it did go round
I
the world.
I need a bowler hat and a flag.
Well,
this, then,
Elgar yes. took the royal nod and indeed the hint there. And in 1902, he wrote it actually in 1901. In 1902, he incorporated it in his coronation ode. It's conducted on this recording by Sir Adrian Bolt, a great friend of Elgar and indeed a champion of his. And, well, what can I say? Elgar wrote five such pomp and circumstance marches. You've guessed it. It has to be number one.
Indeed it does. The London Philharmonic Orchestra. This is an EMI disc, of course, isn't it?
Indeed.
Richard, you've been a star bringing us all these things. Your collection must be enormous by now.
Absolutely. It certainly is. Yes, I hope so. Well, I'll be flogging him down Fleet Street or somewhere on the barrels. Right,
this man knows everything there is to know about classical music. So,
nice compliment. Thank you.
If you're listening to national broadcasters of that type of stuff, he'd like to come through your doors tomorrow.
Yes, I'm very happy. Yes, I am available. As this.
Richard, thank you for that. And we do go out with this. On this occasion, there will be no encore, I'm sad to say, because we have to go to the LBC Traffic Centre, and here's Rob Byrne. Good morning, Rob.
Yeah, thanks very much, Steve. Stirring stuff on a Sunday morning. West London looking busy. Shepherd's Bush Road, lane restrictions there between the Sterndale Road and Brook Green. That's for some roadworks. Just to the south of that, Hammersmith Broadway junction with Shepherd's Bush Road. Some lane restrictions there due to gas works that are going on this morning. A4 Tailgarth Road between Hammersmith Flyover and Glidden Road. You've got one lane out each way. That'll become a little slow today. And Knightsbridge at the junction with Hyde Park Corner. There's a crane operating there until 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. In the meantime, there's no access westbound into Knightsbridge from Hyde Park Corner. Eastbound on Knightsbridge is not affected. You can have access to Hyde Park Corner, and westbound traffic on Piccadilly able to use the underpass and avoid all the problems. Marylebone Road a little slow already westbound around the junction with Gloucester Place.
The Big Easy. Does it do a good business lunch? No.
It does one hell of a business lunch.
The Big Easy, Old Compton Street, Soho. It really is the business.
Rob Byrne, LBC Traffic.
Rob, thank you. After the news at 9, I'll be talking to Frank Dobson, MP, at the Blackpool Conference of the Labour Party this year. And we'll also go round the world to find out whether they smack or not the bodies of their little nippers. And also Liz Fraser will join us to talk about two of the late stars of Dad's Army. Stay with us on LBC.
Breast enlargement can give you the curves you always wanted with a totally natural shape. The Transform team of highly qualified professionals and surgeons take care of everything. To look good and feel good, phone the Transform Clinic for confidential help and advice about breast enlargement on 071 631 1980.
From October the 5th, will you be listening in black and white or colour?
We all talk about the weather. The British are famous for it, and with good reason. We've all gone out in brilliant sunshine and come back soaked to the skin. Well, I'm Louise Lear, and on London News 97.3 FM, I'll bring you the most advanced weather reports on radio. With a complete radar picture of London, I'll see where the rain's going and when the sunshine will arrive. Don't get caught without your brolly. Tune to London News 97.3 FM. We'll get you home and dry.
London News 97.3 FM. All news, all the time.
LBC News Talk 97.3. News.
It's 9 o'clock. Ulster Unionist MP Ken McGuinness is flying to Washington today to take part in a televised debate with Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. It's the first time a loyalist politician has agreed to share a platform with Republicans. Mr McGuinness says it's time the Americans saw the real Gerry Adams on TV.
One cannot really allow Mr Adams a free run yet again on coast-to-coast television on the Larry King Live show. He needs to be confronted with the reality of the activities of Sinn Féin IRA, and that's exactly what I think that's what the American public need.
A Finnish vessel with remote control cameras has set off to try to film the wreck of the Estonia in the Baltic Sea. It's been delayed for 2 days because of bad weather. It'll take 6 hours to reach the site of the disaster, and it's hoped the pictures it takes will prove whether a faulty bow door was to blame for the ferry going down. Two more Indian states have ordered the closure of schools and colleges because of fears the plague may strike students. The relatively rich Punjab and Haryana states are also worried that students coming from other areas may bring in the infection. Labour leader Tony Blair is bracing himself for a showdown with left-wingers at this week's party conference in Blackpool. A major rally later today will push for a high minimum wage and a commitment to traditional socialist values. But our political correspondent in Blackpool, Ed Boyle, says Mr Blair will ride out the storm.
Blair will emerge, nevertheless, as the man they want to trust and the man in whom they are now pinning their hopes. If a party like this has lost, as it has the last four general elections, it doesn't want to go into the next one with an expectancy of losing it because they're divided.
Hollywood actress Whoopi Goldberg is reported to have married film industry union organiser Lyle Trachtenberg in a secret but star-studded ceremony at her California home. Videotape shot by news helicopters above her mansion showed a bride in a white gown and a groom taking their vows in the back garden. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Steven Spielberg were spotted among the guests there. For Reuters Radio News, I'm Douglas Hardy.
All your troubles are supposed to come in threes, aren't they? Well, mine came in fours. And making sure I've got a regular supply of nappies for the quads doesn't leave me much time to think about paying the gas bill. So I get the bank to do it for me. They transfer the same amount every month by direct debit.
To make things easier for you, British Gas offer different ways to pay your gas bill. You can use direct debit to pay monthly, by post to British Gas, or if you prefer, you can pay free of charge at your local post office.
I just chose what suited me, or rather what suited these little terrors.
Call 0500 43 44 45 and we'll give you more details on the different ways you can pay. British Gas, flexible payments.
Right, the time now, 3 minutes past nine. Let's see if we're going to get good weather at the London Weather Centre. It's Ian Forsyth. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I think we've had the best of the weather the last few days. That's the dry weather's coming to an end later on. For today, though, I think certainly some bright spells this morning, staying dry, one or two bright intervals. But as we go through the afternoon, becoming much more cloudy. And I think then later tonight we'll see some rain. Temperatures this afternoon, 16 or 17 degrees at best. That's the low 60s Fahrenheit with a moderate southwesterly breeze. That rain arriving this evening, it's already showing up in the radar to the west, over the west coast, and some of it probably in the heavy side overnight. It should clear away by morning, though, and then tomorrow I think it's a gradually brightening up process. But it will be a lot colder tomorrow. I think that's going to be the main change in the weather over the next few days. Scattered showers, much colder tomorrow afternoon. Temperatures at best 12 or 13 in the afternoon, so about 5 degrees lower than today. And then by Tuesday morning, staying mainly dry and cold, and maybe even a bit of frost in the grass by Tuesday morning. This is Ian Forsyth at London Weather Centre.
Hello, I'm Sharma Pereira, and I'll be with you Friday to Sunday mornings from the 5th of October on 11:52 a.m. with...
Frank Boff. From 6, we'll be tackling the great and the good on the stories of the day.
As well as getting your views on the matters that you care about.
And because London's the most vibrant city in the world, we'll be looking at everything you could be doing with your weekend.
Plus all the issues that affect your lifestyle.
So, if you retune to 11:52 a.m, you can join us for breakfast Friday to Sunday.
And start your weekend in style.
Five across, six down. Off a bit in eucalyptus trees. Oh, koala.
What's that?
Koala, but six down is...
Kuala Lumpur, capital of Malaysia.
Clever clog.
Landed-inspired Somerset Maugham, Anthony Burgess.
It'll be modern now.
It is, but old colonial too, Malacca, Penang.
How do you know?
Where on earth can you get away from it all? Malaysia, fascinating destinations. Call 071-930-7932
now.
You didn't!
This is the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
Whatever you do, wherever you go, you'll have more fun with the radio.
At home or in your car.
Out on the lake or your backyard. So whatever you do, wherever you go, take your radio.
Oh, yes, it's the best form of communication, there's no doubt about that. So wherever you go, do take a radio, because I'll pop up on one near you before too long. There's no doubt about that. It's the last breakfast show we have for you, as far as I'm concerned, on the weekends here. But as you've been hearing already, on the medium wave band, you'll get Frank Boff and Sharma Pereira from next weekend onwards. And, of course, all the news on 97.3. It's now 6 minutes past 9 o'clock. And as we heard earlier, the Labour Party is gathering in Blackpool for the start of their annual conference. It's been something of a year of reorganisation, of course, for the party. The tragic death of John Smith and then the election of their new leader, Tony Blair, who has been well ahead in the polls ever since that election. On the line now is Frank Dobson, the London MP for Holborn and St Pancras. Good morning to you, Frank.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yes, very good to be with you today. Are you in Blackpool or are you up there already? Or
yes, I'm here in the rain.
Yes. Well, is it good to be a dismal or a bright conference, therefore?
Well, if you go outside the conference hall, it looks as though it's going to be dismal, but I think it'll be fairly bright inside. I think the party's in very good heart, but certainly not complacent, because I think we've still got a long way to go.
Well, there's a long way to go, of course, until the next general election. What people are looking for now is something very specific in the way of policies. Do you think we're going to get that this week?
Well, yes. What John Smith had decided to do, quite rightly, was that for the first couple of years after the general election, we'd got to keep pounding away at the Tories and, if possible, establish a reasonably good lead, and then over the next year or so, come out with three or four basic themes, basic policies, and then come up with more specific policies in the last year or 18 months as we run up to the election. And I think that that's what we'll be doing. And over the next year, we'll be emphasising that really what we want is a Britain at work rather than the Britain on benefits. We want to try to promote the idea of partnership, so Britain, people all over Britain in big cities and rural areas are living in places where they feel safe. And also, we want to make sure that we're doing things for our children and young people so that they've got good prospects.
I imagine you will probably share those desires with both Mr. Major and Paddy Ashdown if it comes to that. So you're talking about a different way of going about it there.
Well, that's right. We're a pretty long stride from... I don't think I'm describing Britain as it is now, am I? So we're a pretty long stride away from the actuality of Mr. Major. And as I say, I think we will be coming out with more specific items. And really, our intention is to have practical answers to the day-to-day problems that real people face.
What you're really talking about, of course, is investment in human resources, and that all boils down to, excuse me, money and where it comes from. And I suppose we began to see the glimmerings of a policy on the economic front from Gordon Brown during the week. I'm certainly not the first person to say that they couldn't understand it. I wonder if you did.
Well, I understand the general drift of it. I didn't listen to the speech, and it was a conference of economists, so you would expect the platform to speak with long words, because certainly the people in the audience do.
At the same time, we've also this week seen and heard from John Prescott, who's had a fairly high profile on the BBC radio yesterday and on Channel 4 television with Clive Anderson. I don't know if you caught that on Friday evening.
I just caught the last minute of Clive Anderson.
Well, when he asked John Prescott about policies, I mean, he feigned to leave the set, in fact, at the time. So, are there any, in fact, in embryo at the moment? That's what people want to know.
Oh, yes, there are. You know, and I know now, roughly speaking, what we're going to be saying at the next election, and so do most of the public. But they want things that are more specific, and as time goes by, they'll become more specific. John Smith, after the last election, set up the big commission on social policy, which is independent of the party and which is going to be reporting at the end of August. End of October. And that, I think, will raise a lot of major issues about the future of the benefit system. But I believe that just from the very first interim document they produce, that they recognise that we've got to have full employment or something like it if we're going to offer people a future and be able to afford a welfare system. We can't have a welfare state that about a third of the population are depending on it. It won't work. What we need is to get far fewer people depending on benefit, and that's why I say really our biggest theme will be a Britain at work rather than Britain on benefit.
Right, well, that might, of course, involve job creation schemes. Also, I know you want to invest more in the health service, also in education. So would it be fair, therefore, to say at this early time that those who are going to be earning a fair amount of money, a large amount of money, should expect to be paying more tax under a Labour government?
Well, I think some of the people who've really profiteered out of what's happened in recent years, you know, the bosses of the water companies, the bosses of the electricity companies, who appear to be doing a perfectly reasonable job for about, you know, 60,000 or 70,000 a year, and who are now apparently we're told they'll only be attracted to doing the job if they're getting 270,000 or 370,000 and some big share swindles and that sort of thing. I think most people in the country think they ought to be paying a bit more tax. I certainly do.
So you haven't got a figure above which people should be paying 50% or 60%.
No,
anymore.
We're not talking in terms of coming a long way down the scale. But there are people, and again, as we've been exposing, and indeed even some of the Tory newspapers have been exposing, there are quite a lot of very, very rich people. They now come to Britain because it's a tax haven, because some rich foreigners can actually come here and avoid paying tax altogether. And I don't think folks who are on Social Security or folks who are on a low wage are all that jolly about the idea of foreign millionaires coming here because they don't pay any tax.
OK, Frank, thanks for joining us this morning. Just one brief word. I did mention earlier on that some of the illuminations weren't on in Blackpool because of an unpaid electricity bill. Have they got them
Is
all
that
shining?
Right?
Yes.
No idea.
All right, well, thanks for joining us this morning.
I hope it's not deducted from the pay of the overpaid boss of the local electricity company.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Frank Dobson there, who's the MP for Holborn and St Pancras. He's Shadow Transport spokesman, of course, and has special responsibility for London, too, in the Labour Party. It's now 12 minutes past nine.
LBC News Talk. 97.3 FM, the voice of London.
Are you relaxed?
Yes.
Good, because I want to talk about your deepest desires. Oh. I want you to imagine with me for a moment and indulge your innermost fantasies.
Okay.
Now, close your eyes. Imagine yourself at London Road Garage, where you see a beautiful new Mercedes-Benz. Now, put yourself inside the Mercedes and run your fingers over the steering wheel. Feels good, yes?
Visit London Road Garage and turn your Mercedes-Benz fantasy into reality. Or call Romford 730-422. And ask about our specially tailored finance packages.
Now tell me, what colour did you imagine your new Mercedes?
Pink.
Pink? Mr. Wilson, you are a very sick individual.
London Road Garage, an extraordinarily fine dealership.
In a moment, we're just going to talk to a man who's contributed his fair share to the Exchequer over the years. At lunchtime today, around about 50 wheelchair athletes will be gathering in Covent Garden at 11 o'clock, in fact, in the West Piazza. There'll be balloons set off, and then they'll be off on a month-long Steel Wheels Can Challenge right around the country. Launching this will be Sir Jimmy Savile, OBE, and he's on the line. Jim, good morning to you.
How do you know that I'm on the line?
You and the leaves, I suppose, at the moment.
This could be a recorded message.
Indeed it could.
Yes,
indeed.
I'm just taking things for granted.
I'm just wondering how to test this in that case. Then, have you got your first cigar of the day on yet, by the way?
As it happens, already been done and dispatched. I was so nervous at being grilled by yourself that I was up at 4 o'clock this morning thinking, should I go through with it? Yeah. The man is going to strip me bare of my secrets.
No, not in the slightest. I want to find out what this is all about, this challenge. Give us a bit of a rundown on it, if you'd be so kind.
What a relief. Yeah. What a relief. I thought I was the target.
No, not in the slightest. No.
Right.
Doing more good works, dear boy.
Never. It's only a rumour. Now then, first of all, it's called Steel Wheels Can Challenge, which is a play on words, because we are exhorting everybody to have their steel cans that they've done away with and consumed the contents recycled. And as they recycle the steel cans, they will be earmarked for the making of steel sports wheelchairs to be given to young athletes who can't really afford them because they're quite expensive. And to this end, we'll be down there, God willing, to set all the guys off and a few gals at 11 o'clock this morning, and they then push all round Britain. I think the first leg is from Elstree to Luton, and then it goes up the coast, and it goes right up to York and Leeds and Newcastle-on-Tyne. There's a separate Scottish push as well. So it's a month long, and it reminds people of all the good things, which is, don't waste things if you can recycle it, and that's really what it's all about.
Right, now these wheelchairs, of course, because you've worked a lot with disabled athletes over the years, they're very special and expensive, as you say. Are they particularly lightweight? They would have to be, I would think.
Yes, there's all sorts of things. Like everything else, technology has hit the wheelchair, which is a good thing, because the old ones were real trundle about us. In fact, a few years ago, when I was running a dance hall in Manchester, a couple of my guys were in chairs, and I challenged them and they challenged me to a 10-lap race round Bellevue with me in a wheelchair. So they brought me this wheelchair and it was the most frustrating thing I've ever done, I should think, in my entire life. Because, first of all, wheelchairs don't do what you tell them. You want to go in a straight line, but it refuses to go in a straight line. These are the old trundly chairs. I was lapped about 8,000 times, so there's one thing I'm not going to do today. If any of the guys says, come on, Jim, have a wheel with us, I'll say, thank you, no thank you, I've lived like that before, and I have every admiration for these super guys, and they're, by now, thank goodness, super chairs.
Well, indeed they are, because we see them every year, of course, and you'll have seen them when you've been running in the London Marathon and other marathons, when the wheelchair athletes are there too. The arms on these guys, and girls, as you say, is quite something. You wouldn't want to arm wrestle them for a pound, would you?
Not even 10 pence, because today I go, hopefully, from Covent Garden to the Spinal Injury Centre at Stoke Mandeville, where I'm going to spend the rest of the weekend. And, of course, all our young guys and gals there, our average age group there is 18, because young people damage themselves more than grown-ups. And so I will be seeing all the embryo athletes there who are just now laid out wondering how they come to be like this. And I can give them this ray of hope and say, look, things may look a bit black just now, but I've just come from the Steel Wheel Challenge and they're going to go right round the country, and one day, if you're a bit of a fighter, you can do the same thing. So it gives them a light, a different sort of light, at the end of their tunnel.
What I was pleased to see in the Commonwealth Games, because I know there are some Commonwealth champions taking part in this too, that the disabled games happened at the same time as the able body games. Do you think that's something which maybe they should do with all the international competitions now?
Yeah, well, slowly but surely, it is happening. In the early days, of course, it was a real Cinderella of sports, and the television never took any notice of it, and papers never took any notice. But I think the London Marathon from 1981 showed what amazing people they are, and it's actually made it very kosher now. It's made it very acceptable, and people can watch wheelchair basketball and all those marvellous things and not feel strange. You see, able-bodied people are not quite sure what they should do to speak to and or whatever with disabled people. It's no fault, it's just that it's just something different. And it's not that they don't want to do the right thing, but they're not quite sure about what they should say or what they should do, so they tend to half turn away and half ignore them. Well, television and this programme... disabled to a degree, so most people have a disability. It's just that some are more obvious than others.
Jim, it's great talking to you this morning.
The elegant way that you get finished. Ladies and gentlemen, I was just about to tell you the story of my life, and this man wanted to go now.
Well, it's the best recording I've ever heard, actually. It's,
now he's funny into me now.
Jimmy, have a great time down at the Piazza. Thanks for being with us today.
Okie dokie.
Right, bye-bye
good
now.
Good morning and God bless.
Thank you very much, Jimmy. So Jimmy Savile, OBE there, live to us, and he was on the line. It was not a recording. And he'll be in the West Piazza in Covent Garden today to get the Steel Wheels Can Challenge underway. And if you're down there, they'll be telling you how you can get involved in sponsorship and contribute as they travel the 800 miles up and down the country.
This is a DHL Worldwide Express time check.
It's 9:19.
DHL Worldwide Express for same-day delivery to Amsterdam, Brussels, Frankfurt and Paris.
Now then, Virginia Bottomley, now then, he's now caught the Jimmy Savile disease, rekindled controversy over the rights of parents and childminders to smack this week when she said that she had smacked her own children. Her remarks were condemned by many voluntary organisations who thought that it's not a particularly good idea. Well, this led us to wonder how parents around the world discipline their children, a question we put, therefore, to those correspondents around the world, starting with Paul Woodley in New York.
A recent survey on this here in America showed that 84% of people feel that spanking is sometimes necessary to discipline a child. But it's not quite as simple as that, as I discovered from Robert Epstein, the founder of the Cambridge Center for Behavioral Studies in Massachusetts, now a research professor at the National University in San Diego.
Well, Americans certainly spank their kids, but we have multiple personalities here. On the surface, we say you shouldn't do that, and there are lots of organizations and so on that try to, quote-unquote, protect children from spanking, and some people even associate spanking or any form of punishment as, quote-unquote, abuse, child abuse. So we have it both ways here. We do spank our kids, but we say publicly that it's an awful thing to do. And occasionally we'll take someone to task for doing it.
Indeed, there have been cases where people have been charged with assault for spanking children in public situations, I recall.
Oh, quite. In fact, if anything, that tendency is growing. It's a very, very unfortunate tendency. But as I say, we play it both ways here. I think what it comes down to is that we do spank our kids, but more and more we try to just do it in secret.
U.S. experts mostly say parents should try to avoid spanking because it does not change behavior. And they point to research here that parents who do spank have more trouble with their children when they get older, and that children who have been spanked tend to have a lower opinion of themselves and have more trouble making friends. Professor Epstein preaches a policy of moderation and says no punishment should be entirely ruled out, but sometimes spanking is necessary and can do more good than harm, though there is a problem in America with lack of parenting skills.
There's a statement I make from time to time when I lecture that is shocking to some people, but in fact I think it's a defensible statement. And that is that almost every adult psychopathology that you can think of, everything from frigidity in sex to extreme shyness to procrastination to eating disorders, practically every adult psychopathology has as its origin punishment in childhood. So, in fact, punishment in childhood can do bad things to people, but that's basically when it's misapplied. That doesn't mean you rule it out. You know, you don't throw away the baby with the bathwater. You don't rule it out entirely. In fact, you need to be educated. You need to know how to punish, when to punish. And again, there are circumstances under which, if you fail to punish, you are harming your child.
So is there a link between America's higher crime rate and punishment for children? Well, Professor Epstein says yes. firstly, because some kids aren't punished enough.
A lot of middle-class, upper-middle-class Americans have bought into this notion that you should never punish. Unfortunately, their kids go wild, completely berserk. And that's where failing to punish does harm to children, and we end up with kids getting into terrible, terrible trouble because they've never really had much constraint or restraint on them.
And the other way is that if a child has been hit too much, they learn that violence is the way to handle problems. But he says don't read too much into all that, because how a child turns out has a lot to do with the overall environment in which they grow up. And culturally, the US is much more violent than other countries. And that, for the very last time, is Inside America.
Paul, thank you very much for that. We're talking about disciplining children. So what happens in Russia? Here's Sue Jameson from Moscow.
Discipline starts young for Russian children. I sometimes find it impossible to believe my friends have grown up as normal as they seem to be, given the awful rigours of being a Russian baby. Children are idolised and certainly not encouraged to grow up too fast. Perhaps this is because most couples only have one child, and therefore their early years are especially precious. Children are not routinely smacked, but they are punished and humiliated, mostly at school, to ensure obedient citizens to the state. At least that must be the theory. But going back to this discipline starting young, how do you persuade a little baby to behave? Well, you make sure it's bound up for the first few months of its life. In some places in Russia, they still bind each leg to ensure the legs are straight and not spoiled by being allowed to kick. One colleague was having his new daughter examined by a doctor who advised him to bind the child a little tighter as she was moving her head about too much. She's nervous, was the doctor's opinion. Not naturally curious, note, but nervous. The other way to ensure your children will obey you is not to give in to them and feed on demand when they're babies. Another Western friend who's just had a baby and has the misfortune of a Russian grandmother-in-law has had a dreadful time recently learning how she's supposed to look after her three-month-old daughter. She's been criticised for the most ridiculous reasons. When feeding the baby, much too often, you should only feed every 3 or 4 hours, she suffered the indignities of the grandmother poking at her ample bosom and declaring, "You're too small to feed properly." The baby, she was informed, should be wrapped in a blanket at all times with a dummy in its mouth when it goes to sleep, and potty training should start at 2 months old. Yes, 2 months, apparently. For those of you listening, fed up with so many nappies, the Russian method is you hold the baby over the pot half an hour after every meal. I'm convinced the lack of washing machines has generated this particular aspect of discipline. Having said all this, Russians love children. My 9-year-old, who's well up to my shoulder, is regularly grabbed and squashed in some fond babushka's embrace while receiving Russian endearments, which are all delivered in that high, affectionate chant that you'd only use on much tinier children in England. I sometimes catch sight of his resigned face as he peeps out from mounds of arms and breasts, appealing silently to me to come to his rescue. But that unquestioned obedience the old system maintained in schools is at last being eroded, very slowly. And while babies will still have an uncomfortable start, the older children in today's Russia are going to want to rebel.
That was Sue Jameson in Moscow. Well, finally we go to Tim Knight in Japan. Do they smack or don't they smack? Well, actually it appears that it's not such a great problem in Tokyo.
The issue of smacking children doesn't seem so controversial here in Japan, except on the rare occasions when it's over the top and leads to injury or death. And even then, the debate tends to focus on that specific case rather than expand into a general one. As in Britain, it seems that some Japanese parents do smack their kids when they're naughty and some don't. It's easy to get the impression, however, that none do, because it's apparently not the done thing in public. Personally, I've never seen a parent hitting a child in Japan. Younger children seem to be indulged very patiently or are spoken to firmly enough to bring them into line. People tell me, though, that at home or even in the family car, some parents do slap their children. Although it's often because parents have got angry because of their children's naughty behaviour, often it's over something related to education, which is considered very important. One woman I know said that when she was a child, her mother grabbed her hair and pulled her down from the piano stool before slapping her. The girl's crime had been not practicing enough and therefore being unable to play a certain piano piece properly. The importance of education and the high level of expectations and aspirations of many parents for their children has led to them leaving a large part of their children's upbringing to teachers and schools, even to the point of teachers hitting their children. But the teachers are like surrogate parents at school, sometimes being remarkably indulgent and sometimes getting very angry through probably frustration. It's never a case of come to my study at 11 o'clock, boy, whereupon the pupil is given 6 lashes with a cane or belt or strap as punishment for some wrongdoing. Here a teacher, and it's more common in some schools than others, will hit or slap a student out of disappointment or anger at the time, rather like the French concept of a crime of passion murder being distinct from murder in cold blood. Teachers defend hitting students as ainomuchi. This means that, like parents, they're hitting the child out of love. They want the student to be good and successful. The ainomuchi argument has been used most in court cases after a teacher displays a bit too much love and injured the child. Sometimes tragedies occur. A couple of weeks ago, a primary school pupil committed suicide a few hours after being slapped by a teacher. The teacher and the school head went to apologize to the parents. The hitting out of love concept extends further into relationships which don't involve children. In television dramas and films, you'll often see a man and woman unable to communicate their feelings for or about each other in words, a common problem especially in Japan, letting their love for each other burst forth in a short flurry of blows. It seems the idea is that if you really care about a loved one, or even about a student, you'll show real emotion, even of the violent kind. Too much coolness is regarded with suspicion and a sign that you don't care, even though this may not be the case. An English friend of mine, happily married for a number of years to a Japanese woman, told me he finally won her over from a Japanese rival when he lost his temper with her once, slapped her a couple of times, and locked her out of his flat. She told him that was when she knew he really loved her, and they got married not long afterwards.
Oh, a little morality tale to finish there with from Tim Knight. Thank you to him and to Sue and also to Paul Woodley, of course, for all of their contributions at the LBC Traffic Centre. Rob Byrne. Hello, Rob.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning once again. East London, Ilford, Hainault Road Junction, Billet Road. There's temporary lights at the junction this weekend. Also a local Cub Scout camp there as well. So a lot of extra traffic expected. Those temporary lights are going to slow things down. Stratford, Great Eastern Road. That's down to one lane between the High Street and Angel Road. Some roadwork continuing there. Old's Court Road junction with Kensington High Street. Some roadworks there. It'll slow for southbound traffic. And Wandsworth Bridge Road at the junction with Townmead Road. The road has been reduced in the width there. There are some lane restrictions and that will slow traffic both ways across Wandsworth Bridge from time to time. And speaking of bridges, Hammersmith Bridge remains closed until 9 o'clock tonight. Public transport, southeastern services that normally run to and from Charing Cross Station are today diverted to and from Cannon Street.
The Big Easy Soho.
It's one hell of a place to hear live music.
Live music 7 nights a week at the Big Easy Old Compton Street Soho. Eating out's never sounded so good.
Rob Byrne at the LBC Traffic Centre.
LBC News Talk 97.3. News.
It's 9:30. I'm Douglas Hardy. Ulster Unionist MP Ken McGuinness is flying to Washington today to take part in a televised debate with the Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. It's the first time a loyalist politician has agreed to share a platform with Republicans. A Finnish vessel equipped with remote control cameras has set off to film the wreck of the Estonia in the Baltic Sea. It's hoped the pictures will prove whether a faulty bow door was to blame for the disaster. The sole British survivor, Paul Barney, has strongly criticised those responsible for safety on the ferry. Schools and colleges in 2 more Indian states have been closed because of continuing fears about the plague. The relatively rich Punjab and Haryana states are also worried that students coming from other areas may bring in the disease. Labour leader Tony Blair is bracing himself for a showdown with left-wingers at this week's party conference in Blackpool. A major rally later today will push for a high minimum wage and a commitment to traditional socialist values. Deputy leader John Prescott has said that the rich would pay more taxes under a Labour government. London's weather now, a dry morning, but it'll remain cloudy. This afternoon, however, should brighten up a little. Temperatures up to around 17 Celsius, 63 Fahrenheit. Winds, though, becoming fairly strong and from the southwest. The next news at 10 o'clock.
That's
nice. Oh, my.
Now, Sunday Telegraph readers can lead more colourful lives.
Oh, that's lovely. That's nice.
Each issue has a coupon worth 50p off any one of a range of leading colour magazines. Vogue, House and Garden, Tatler, The World of Interiors, GQ, Vanity Fair, and The Spectator. The Sunday Telegraph. The Sunday that comes with a choice of colour. Step back in time as you enter London's only underground prison with cells that have remained closed for 150 years. Take the dark walk to the deepest and darkest of cells, once inhabited by more than 10,000 prisoners a year. Visit the House of Detention at Clerkenwell Close, just off Clerkenwell Green EC1. Open from 10 till 6, 364 days a year. The House of Detention, for the crime of your life. 071-253-9494.
Sport on the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
That's true, friends, and with it is Johnny Gould. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Well, Chelsea, fresh from European Cup Winners' Cup success in the week, go back into the cauldron against West Ham this afternoon. It's a London derby at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea central defender Alan Johnson says, like all derby matches, it'll be hard fought.
They've had a bit of a difficult start, and that's going to be a really difficult one. Of course, it's a derby as well. So, but we need some points now, so we're just going there full of confidence. But that, you know, we know we can play, and just have to keep playing like we do.
Well, West Ham languishing in the bottom four without the suspended Tony Cotty, with Chelsea's Dennis Wise in the same predicament. Queen's Park Rangers also playing today at Nottingham Forest, unbeaten in seven matches of the East Midlanders, and they could move to within 2 points of Newcastle with a win. Well, the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe, European Racing's Blue Ribbon event, is run at Longchamp at 4:20 this afternoon, with plenty of British interest. There's Only Royal, ridden by Frankie Dettori, trained at Newmarket by Luca Kamani. And another promising runner is Broadway Flyer, runner-up in the St. Ledger. Croydon's Duke McKenzie failed in his bid to become the first boxer to win four world titles at different weights. He made an unsuccessful challenge for the WBO featherweight title in Cardiff last night against Steve Robinson. He was floored with a savage punch to the chest in the ninth round. Well, the class field is now at this moment running the Bupa Great Caledonian Run. It's a 10-kilometre challenge through central Edinburgh. And good early news for defending champion London's Gary Staines. Joining us live from Edinburgh, here's Ian Wilson.
Bupa Great Caledonian Run is underway, and 5 minutes into the race, the leader is Gary Staines of Belgrave Harriers, last year's defending champion. The competitors are setting a fast pace, not surprising with some of the top-class runners in the field. They're approaching now the main Edinburgh Road. Stevie Starr must have motivated to let them off, but now the main names are taking over. More than 4,000 runners in all, but Gary Staines of Belgrave Harriers is the defending champion. He's looking good right now.
That's Ian Wilson joining us live from Edinburgh. Meanwhile, defending champions Bath in Rugby Union are still leading the National League One following their 15-10 defeat of Gloucester. Harlequins are back on track with a convincing home win over West Hartlepool in yesterday's Heineken match of the day. Quinn's fly half Paul Challoner, widely tipped as a future England number 10, says they weren't prepared to let their lead slip.
We went 14 points up early second half, and we thought, uh-oh, here goes again. They scored a try and down 7 points. And basically we just had to hang in, make lots of tackles, and eventually we got 10 points ahead and we hung on.
And that's the sport this morning, Steve. What about the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe a bit later?
The Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe, yes, so I'm looking forward to that. But just before I give you my mate's tip for that, have you any subtitles for that Ian Wilson report there?
Yes, I know, yes. slightly, it was worth a gamble, wasn't it? He's in the back of a bus, yes. Following the race around. And, yes.
No. It was live and it was happening.
Well, that's the way it goes. You take a punt on these things sometimes.
That's the way it is. Well, I shall be taking a punt today. Yes. I had to do it yesterday, I have to say, because the book is not yet open on Sundays here.
Right.
Could well come in the not-too-distant future, but in the Peter Larkin Trio, it's King's Theatre, because I've worked I've worked in so many of that name over the years.
Fancy your chances.
Yeah, and my mate said, well, why not have a go on that? You know, so I will.
Well, then there's Broadway Flyer, runner-up in the St. Ledger.
Yes, that's true.
And Frankie Dettori, partnered by Only Royale.
Yeah, well, of course, Frankie had that that wonderful win yesterday in the William Hill Cambridgeshire Handicap. An 8-1 chance there, Halling. It was 8-1. It was the co-favourite, and ours ringmaster. I've still, of course, they only print the first three, don't they? In the newspaper,
that's right.
So I'm not too sure where it came in,
whether it happened or not.
But I'll be into my local Honest Bob's tomorrow and see whether or not I'm going to make a killing on that.
Indeed. And what about the Hammers this afternoon at Chelsea?
Well, the Hammers at Chelsea this afternoon, I think could get a draw out of it.
Yeah?
Yes.
I mean, it would be a good result. Mm,
but they don't call it a draw these days. It is a result now, isn't it? If
you get it's a result, isn't it, mate?
Yes, we've got to get a result there. But I think they will be missing Tony Cotty, but at the same time, as your colleague Ian Abrahams was saying yesterday, we do carry our top goal scorer, Steve Potts, with two, but unfortunately, they're both own goals.
Oh, dear. That is excellent. Yes, of course, West Ham's first goal of the season was an own effort against Newcastle, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Never mind. But Chelsea, I mean, you might catch them on the hop, of course. I mean, look at Aston Villa yesterday. You know, 48 hours from beating Inter Milan, of course, they're absolutely knackered, and they couldn't raise themselves for such a great game and lost 2-0 to Newcastle.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, this is a great opportunity for the Hammers.
Well, I think it probably is today. I don't suppose that twice in a week Graham Rix is going to turn out for the first 11, is he?
I wouldn't imagine so. It was very much a makeshift side, and I think if Ken Bates has serious aspirations for European honours for Chelsea, he's going to have to go and buy an English midfielder.
Yes, I think you're right.
I mean, immediately.
Yes, well, so many teams are going to have to do that. Thank you, dear John.
You're welcome, Steve.
And I shall see you soon.
See you very soon.
All right, cheers, mate.
Take care.
Thanks, bye-bye. Johnny Gould there with the sport. Now, on the Sunday agenda between 10 and midday today, you've had Martin Young, you've had Geoffrey Goodman, but now, for your delectation and delight, we bring you financial editor Robin Amlow. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Steve. Again,
yes. Yesterday, bright and early with us at the financial spot. And then, of course, at lunchtime yesterday, you were talking money, weren't you?
We were indeed. No rest for the wicked.
No. You're not going to concentrate merely on matters financial today, though, I imagine.
No. We will. Well, I perhaps we should get that out of the way first. Hey, we will be covering matters financial. We'll be turning the spotlight on the agenda to Labour's economic policy, which Gordon Brown unveiled with a whirlwind of words that nobody could actually understand this week. So we'll be asking Joan Lester exactly what it was he was trying to tell us. Given that the World Bank and the IMF have turned 50 and everybody was junketing in Madrid over the past week, and the group of seven industrialised nations is meeting in as we speak with a communique expected from them around about 5:30 this afternoon, we'll be taking a look at what's in store for the world economy as well. These are not our major stories, though. We'll be looking very closely at the Estonia ferry disaster. How did it happen? Why was it allowed to happen, particularly after the Herald of Free Enterprise tragedy? What's the future for roll-on, roll-off ferries? Seems to me that if you're going to go across to France, you have two choices. You can either go through a tunnel that leaks, or you can go on a roll-on, roll-off ferry, which may not get there at all. It's a very worrying subject, and one we'll be looking at very closely. President Clinton's policy in Haiti, winning him few friends at home, and even fewer in Latin America, it would seem. The future for NATO, you have the world's biggest military alliance with lots of rough, tough men in uniform and nobody left to fight. What's the future for the alliance? They have a new man at the helm as of Thursday, Willy Claes, a Belgian politician. What's his job going to be for the future? And amongst other stories, the plague, of course, the threat from India, Gerry Adams preparing to barnstorm Washington, and a very, very sinister story. We'll be talking to author Margaret Humphreys about her book Empty Cradles and the scandal of 150,000 British children shipped out to the colonies in the 50s and 60s.
OK, that's Robin Amlow between 10 and midday with the Sunday Agenda here on LBC. Thank you, Robin. And we're going to talk about how we'll be motoring around in the 21st century after this.
From October the 5th, will you be listening in black and white or colour?
Away finally in the 100 metres final and Christie is baffling half flat.
Somewhere in London, somewhere in the world, someone's making news. Whatever the hour, wherever it's happening, London News 97.3 FM will bring it to you. From our London headquarters and Reuters correspondents around the world, we'll give you access to the best news and information service right through the night. We'll be here when you need us most, all the time, anytime.
London News 97.3 FM. All news, all the time. This is the Steve Jones Breakfast Show.
Well, when you sit in your car in a traffic jam tomorrow morning, watching all the cars around you churning out exhaust fumes and, of course, consuming vast amounts of petrol, you may wonder if there isn't something better. What happened to the petrol or diesel-free engine? What's the future for the electric vehicle, the supercharged milk float? Well, that's a question that Geoffrey Daniels has been addressing, and he's just produced a report on the future of engine design for the Economist Intelligence Unit, and he's with me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
So the electric vehicle, according to you, is not the car of the future. Why is that?
Well, it just isn't efficient enough. The problem with any electric vehicle is it has to be powered by batteries. Batteries are extremely heavy, and the vehicle has to tow them around all the time. You're running with a built-in handicap, in effect. I mean, people are looking at more advanced batteries, but the trouble is that these seem to be taking a very long time to develop, and nobody knows how expensive they're going to be. Mm. So the car manufacturers in particular really don't want to get into electric vehicles until they can see how the situation's going to develop economically. And at the moment, the future is full of uncertainty. The only thing they know is that the Californians have said that from 1998 they've got to sell a small proportion of electric vehicles if they're going to be allowed to sell vehicles in the state at all.
Right, that's a United States legislative directive then, is it?
It's a Californian state directive.
Oh, right.
which some of the other American states are now looking at very seriously. And of course, if the Americans do get it up and running, the chances are that some European governments may look at it too, the Germans and the Scandinavians in particular.
Right, so we've got to look therefore at other liquid fuels, presumably, for the future. I mean, are there suitable alternatives to the petrol or diesel driven engine?
Oh, there are a lot of alternatives that people are looking at. The trouble is that the moment you really start looking at them in any depth, they start throwing up drawbacks of their own. People got very enthusiastic about methanol as a fuel. Methanol, of course, is one of the two kinds of alcohol. So one of the things you have to do is dream up some way of discouraging people from drinking it before they put it in their cars. Seriously, apart from that, when people started running methanol-fueled cars, they discovered that one of the unlooked-for side products that came down the exhaust pipe was formaldehyde. Now, anybody who's ever done O-level biology knows that formaldehyde is something that stinks to high heaven. So now the Californians, who are also encouraging methanol as a fuel, are writing limits on the amount of formaldehyde they're allowed to produce. The moment you try and solve one problem, it's a bit like squeezing a balloon. You know, you squeeze it in one place and it starts to come out somewhere else. There's no easy answer. The long-term answer, the dream fuel, as people would say, is hydrogen. If you burn hydrogen in an engine, then of course you produce, in theory, nothing but water. The trouble with hydrogen, of course, is how do you store it in the vehicle?
Yes.
You know, it's a gas unless you bring the tank down to something like absolute zero, really fearsomely
so driving around with a refrigeration unit in your car as well as anything else.
Well, that's quite conceivable, yes. It certainly raises horrifying problems of how you store the gas, how you refuel the vehicle. Mm. These are things that people sometimes don't think about. They think, oh, how marvellous to run a lovely clean fuel in your car. They don't think, well, how am I going to transfer it from the tank in the garage to the tank in my car?
Sure.
With liquid hydrogen, it's going to be a fairly fearsome, safety-intensive process.
Of course, and the same problem, of course, with recharging the batteries. Now, we've got about a minute left, so we're talking here about having to find more oil-based, fuel-efficient engines, therefore, are we not? And surely huge advances are being made there.
They are indeed. If you're sensible about this, I think you have to say that what's coming up is many more advanced engines, which will be far more economical, especially if they're running much lighter cars. People will argue the relative merits of the petrol and diesel engines uphill and down dale. I think there'll probably be room for both. But in 20 years' time, there's a very fair chance that we'll still be driving around in cars that have very advanced versions of the sort of engines that we're driving around with today.
Right, and a very quick word on rapeseed oil, which I know can produce an alternative to diesel. I mean, presumably we couldn't grow enough of that to provide the fuel that we need.
We certainly couldn't grow enough of it to provide all the fuel we need. It's one of the many alternatives, again, that people are looking at, specifically for diesel engines. You can't run it in anything but a diesel. It's not quite as simple as people would like to believe. You have to run it through an industrial process. It's not actually the answer to a diesel engine driver's prayer, and it could turn out to be fairly expensive too.
Okay, Geoffrey, thank you for joining us this morning. Good to talk to you.
It's thank a you.
Very interesting report that I've read there from Geoffrey Daniels. He made it, of course, for the Economist Intelligence Unit. And you're listening to the Steve Jones Breakfast Show on LBC. We've got more guests, I think, just waiting to pop into the studio.
A bigger breakfast on the weekend with Steve Jones.
Well, of course, over the past few years on this programme, as well as bringing you the news of the day each and every Saturday and Sunday, we've looked at the lighter side of life. We like a giggle, we like a laugh from time to time. And on occasions, we have either spoken to David Graham, chairman and founder of the Dead Comic Society, or Ian Fenn has gone out and had words with him as they're sticking up one of their famous plaques on the wall to entertainers and comedians who are no longer with us. And David is with us in the studio today to talk about the latest two plaques which are going to be put up later this morning. With him is one of our leading, I was going to say comic actresses, but in fact he's done a fair amount of serious work too in her career, and that's Liz Fraser. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Good morning, Steve.
And welcome. Well, we're talking about John Lemessurier and Arthur Lowe here, aren't we, David? It's yes. Both of whom departed his life some while ago, a couple of years anyway, certainly. So
much earlier than that.
Was it really?
It was back in the early 80s.
You're kidding
yes,
me.
Yes, Arthur died a long time ago.
Yes.
Right. Arthur died before John.
Mm. So why has it taken so long to get the plaques up and going then?
Because there's such a demand for these plaques to go up in the first place. And each event, as you know, takes about 5 months to put together, so mm-hmm. we can just about manage two events a year and usually do a double each year at the same time, and there's a heck of a long list.
Mm. And it didn't start immediately, this society didn't start immediately after all these people no. died anyway, did it?
It was 3 years
So
ago.
We've got to catch up. Mm. But well, there's one of those, as soon as you get up to date, somebody else sort of passes over.
Yeah, well, of course, it's a natural thing in life. It does happen. But we do have this great heritage here as well, of course. And these people today being remembered by, well, yourself, Liz, among a fabulous lineup of celebrities, all of whom are official members, David, of the Society, or friends of the Society, or what?
Some are official members, some are members of the celebrity committees, others are directors of either the company or the charitable trust. There's a great deal of interest in this within the business now, deal of support as well.
Well, let me mention just a few names. Of course, Clive Dunn, Bill Pertwee, Ian Lavender, and others from the cast of Dad's Army. Jack Douglas, hey, Anita Dobson, and with Anita Dobson, you do get Brian May, formerly of Queen, of course. They're the latest double act around. Sue Nichols and Mark Eden. Mark, as you remember, was out of Coronation Street a couple of years ago, knocked over by a tram.
What a way to go.
It was a terrible thing. How many times did you have the opportunity, Liz, to work with either Arthur Lowe or John Lemessurier?
Well, I worked with John Lemes several times on various films. I think the first time we met on film was in I'm All Right, Jack.
All right, yes.
Where he was the man with the tick in his face doing the time and motion.
Yeah.
And I worked subsequently with John quite a few times. With both of them, I did the film of Dad's Army. I played Mrs. Pike in the film.
So you did, yes.
But on radio, I did a couple of series, 13-week series, with Arthur Lowe called Parsley Sidings and with Ian Lavender.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to know him through radio, really.
I don't recall that series, which is very remiss of me.
Well,
Pasty
Sidings was about a little railway station in England, and I was the announcer, and he was the station master, and it was great fun.
Yeah. The amazing thing, of course, about both of them in this particular series of Dad's Army is that the BBC, it seems to me, could go on repeating those shows week in, week out, week in, week out, and they would still get the same audience. They beat what a lot of the current news stuff does, in terms of ratings anyway, don't they?
That's absolutely correct. I think someone said that the audience figures nowadays are sometimes better than they were when it originally started. It's one of those evergreens. If you look at Dad's Army, it doesn't look dated, as some of the other programmes from that time would.
Mm.
And I think if it's... Well, it will be shown in many, many years to come. It will never look dated, so
well,
it'll be there for
all
generations.
Because it was of that period.
That's right,
yes.
Whereas some things were made in that period, but they weren't necessarily of that period. I mean, Dad's Army was the group of men during the war, so it will never be dated because that situation always existed.
That's
did
right.
that but make sense?
Yes, it did. I think it did. I mean, and I think what you're saying is, too, that as well as being extremely amusing, it's also a piece of our history in many ways,
yes,
too, that people will look at in years to come and say, really, is that what we used to do? Because, as with the best comedies, there's always a strong element of truth in them, isn't there?
Yes.
You know? So that all happens today, and you're supporting your usual charities, David, I assume?
Yes, the British Heart Foundation, Aspire, and the Grand Order of Water Rats, three very good causes.
Right. The Water Rats, presumably that's why Bert Whedon is going to be around as well. Is he King Rat this year still?
No, he's Roger
he
de Courcy.
Oh, he was yes, King Rat. King Rat last year.
Yes.
Bert was last year,
Roger,
wasn't it?
It's Roger de Courcy.
All right, so...
And the bear, presumably, is Prince Rattling or something.
Something like
no,
that.
No, Furry Rattling.
Oh, Furry Rattling, is he?
So, well, I don't know. Is there going to be a bit of Nookie around then today? Is there on?
Yes, we'll try not to look, but probably.
So, these plaques are going up where the guys were born, or where they lived the majority of their lives, or what?
It's where they lived. Normally, when the plaques go up, I talk to the family and say to them, where would you like the plaque to go? Because it's very much a case of working with, you know, the nearest and dearest and the families. And Stephen, Arthur's son's coming down from Scotland, where he now lives up near Inverness, and he suggested Maeder Avenue, and Joan Lemage, John's widow, said that she'd like it to go up at this other block of flats over in Hammersmith. So that's where we're chasing over to later on this morning.
Oh, good. Well, thank you for dropping in to see us on your way to do that. But before you both depart, though, I'm just talking of things which are revived and come back and do amazingly well. How about these edited together bits of the Carry On movies, Liz? I mean,
I've never seen one.
Have you not? Just for Laughs, I think it comes under. Is the umbrella
yes.
title?
It's a compilation.
It's a compilation
yes.
thing.
Yeah. I've never. Well, usually I never watch myself on the television anyway. But on principle, I don't watch any of those because, as you know, we're all chopped and banded together, and you never get any residuals and things. But I'm never interested in seeing myself in the clips.
No.
Particularly.
No.
I only did three of the carry-ons anyway, so probably I haven't been in many of the clips.
Well, I don't know, because what they tend to do is they put them out over and over again. Yes, Dave, what were you going to say?
No, I was going to say, I was going to get a plug in here, because that's the next plaque we're doing in February to Gerald Thomas.
Oh, right.
The daddy of the carry-on film.
Yes, yes.
I mean, he's not a dead comic, he's not a comedian, but he was very much influential, you know, on that particular area, which was British film comedy.
Right. Talking of I'm All Right, Jack, of course, which Liz mentioned, working in the film with John Le Mesurier. Is there a plaque to Peter Sellers? I've forgotten now.
Yes, that was the very first one.
What was it now?
Muswell Hill Road. It was stolen, funny enough, May last year. We've never found it. We've had it replaced, but... It suddenly disappeared off the wall. Probably Peter decided to come and get it now.
Is that the only problem of theft that you suffered, in fact?
Touch wood. There is some wood still in it. Yes.
I suppose, basically, most of them are high up. I mean, if it's in a block of flats, the plaque's got to be, they've got to climb up the stairs.
Yes, yeah.
When I go, you can put mine just sort of on the left of the window box. And that'll be nicked very quick.
You don't have any local authority problem with these, then, at all?
It depends on the building you're going on to. If you're going to go for a Grade 2 listed or a property that's looked after by English Heritage, then you must go through the proper procedures. You have to go for planning permission and various other consents, because you must do it the right way. But there are other barrows, for instance, with the Peter Sellers, Haringey. We rang them and said, do you mind? And they said, no, you know, carry on. Depends on the borough, depends on the house.
Right. OK, well, again, both of you, thanks for being with us. And also, thanks to Liz's dog, who has been here throughout the proceedings. What sort of a hound is this, Liz?
Well, he's a Basset hound. His name is Bracken. He's 16 months, and he's reasonably good. He's very famous in Fulham. He growled at a judge recently in a hound show. There were 148 Bassets, and he was the only one who managed to get a growl up. So he got a reserve. So I received £1 for that towards the petrol, because the show was in Stafford, but he was in disgrace.
Was it? A dog pound, that was indeed.
Ooh. Yeah, you want a plaque as
very,
well?
That's very good. Gosh, that's good.
Oh, yes, OK. Well, if that counts as being comedic, then put me down for one in about 50 years' time.
We've
got
you down.
OK, David Graham, Liz Fraser, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Right, let's kickstart Rob Burt now. He's waiting for us at the LBC Traffic Centre. Good morning, Rob.
Thanks very much, Steve. Very good morning once again. Good morning, London. Out in the west, Hammersmith Broadway, junction with Shepherd's Bush Road. Some restrictions there due to gasworks today. That will become very busy indeed. Old Court Road at the junction with Kensington High Street. Some roadworks there affecting southbound traffic. Wandsworth Bridge Road at the junction with Townmead Road. We've got reduction in the width of the road through there. As a result of that, you'll find traffic across Wandsworth Bridge may be slow at times today. And Hammersmith Bridge, that's closed until 9 o'clock this evening for maintenance work. Strand Underpass is also closed for maintenance. And Knightsbridge at the junction with Hyde Park Corner, there's a crane operating there today. In fact, it's operating until 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. In the meantime, there's no accessed westbound into Knightsbridge from Hyde Park Corner. Victoria Embankment, you'll find the going a little slow there underneath the Waterloo Bridge. Lane restrictions affecting traffic both ways. And we've still got the lights out. Tailgarth Road junction with Glidden Road. Public transport, no reported problems on London Underground. On Thames Link, we've got London Bridge to Luton services today starting and terminating at Farringdon Station. Services Bedford to Brighton will not call at London Bridge. And on the South East Line, all services to and from Charing Cross are diverted today to and from Cannon Street.
Products and services for all your business needs. The Enterprise Business and Computing Show. Wembley, 7th to the 9th of October. Call 081 982 6600.
Rob Byrne at the LBC Traffic Centre.
Well, as you will have gathered if you've been with me since 7 o'clock this morning, we haven't wanted to wax too nostalgic on this final show. But to close with today, here's a theme which may jog a few memories. Yes, the Jones Boy, which we played every lunchtime between 87 and 89, when the lucky seven Wheel of Fortune brought prizes galore to our quiz contestants. And Dwight D. Donovan kept me going with Banter and Benson's. And Dwight's brother Gary has produced this weekend show for many years now, heading the Top Talk team, which was first formed back in June 1985. Contributors, production staff and engineers are too numerous to mention, but to Amanda, Steve, Scoop, Anne, Tom, Lisa, Funny Fenny, John, Alvin, Uncle Tom Cobley, and all, I say thank you very much. But most of all, of course, we say thank you to you for tuning our way each Saturday and Sunday between 7 and 10 for the bigger, brighter breakfast show. You know I'm going to miss you.
Well, the whole town's talking about the Jones Boy. Nice boy, Jones Boy. This just happens to be the Jones Boy.
Wishing London News and London News Talk well, and looking forward to being on a radio near you in the not-too-distant future. So for now, from me, Steve Jones, it's not goodbye, it's simply au revoir.
nice.
Now, Sunday Telegraph readers can lead more colourful lives.
Oh, that's lovely. That's nice.
Each issue has a coupon worth 50p off any one of a range of leading colour magazines. Vogue, House and Garden, Tatler, The World of Interiors, GQ, Vanity Fair, and The Spectator. The Sunday Telegraph. The Sunday that comes with a choice of colour.
LBC News Talk 97.3. News.
It's 10 o'clock. Ulster Unionist MP Ken McGuinness is flying to Washington today to take part in a televised debate with Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. It's the first time a loyalist politician has agreed to share a platform with Republicans. Mr. McGuinness says it's time the Americans saw the real Gerry Adams on TV.
One cannot really allow Mr. Adams a free run yet again on coast-to-coast television on the Larry King Live show. He needs to be confronted with the reality of the activities of Sinn Féin IRA, and that's exactly what I think, that's what the American public need.
The World Health Organization says the next 2 days are crucial in determining whether the plague in India has been controlled. Quarantine restrictions in the city where the disease broke out failed, and victims turned up in other parts of the country, including New Delhi. A WHO spokesman said if the plague emerged in new, unexpected areas, there could be a long haul ahead. Nelson Mandela has arrived in New York for a week-long visit to the United States. He'll meet political leaders, including Bill Clinton, but his main aim is to attract American business to South Africa. Despite the removal of apartheid, investment analyst Bill Moses says President Mandela still has a huge job ahead of him to change the image of his country.
People in America sort of see South Africa and see Rwanda, and that's another sort of issue that Mandela still probably has to work on for some businessmen, is that South Africa is a different country, that South Africa is a country where there's a commitment to democracy and you can do business, which is not the same as it is in many other African countries.
Fighting between the Khmer Rouge and the Cambodian government is reported to have stopped, and it's thought that talks between the two sides could begin soon. The condition of Briton Mark Slater from Corby in Northamptonshire and two other Westerners being held hostage isn't known. It's been more than a month since the outside world has heard from them. For Reuters Radio News, I'm Douglas Hardy.
The Voice of London on 97.3 FM, LBC News Talk.
London's weather now. This morning will remain dry, but it will be cloudy. It should brighten up this afternoon, though, but the cloud will thicken up later on in the evening again. Temperatures around 17 Celsius, 63 Fahrenheit. The wind becoming stronger as the day progresses to end up as a fairly brisk southwesterly. The next news is at 10:30.
Good morning, it's 3 minutes past ten. You're listening to the Sunday Agenda with me, Robin Amlow. On the agenda between now and 12, the ferry Estonia. What really happened? How could it be allowed to happen again after the Herald of Free Enterprise tragedy? What is the future of roll-on, roll-off ferries? We'll be talking to Walter Welsh, Director of Marine Services for the Chamber of Shipping, responsible for maritime safety, and Lloyd's of London spokesman Nick Doak. Haiti. President Clinton's foreign policy wins him few friends at home and appears to be doing little for his popularity in Latin America either. NATO, the world's biggest military alliance, searches for a new role with a new man at the helm. And on a lighter note on the subject of men in uniform, the Dead Comics Society honours Arthur Lowe and John LeMessurier of Dad's Army. Labour's economic policy comes under the spotlight. Gerry Adams is set to barnstorm Washington. The global village, the result of fast communications, jet travel and so on, how much of a threat to us is the plague outbreak in India? The World Bank and the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, turn 50. Is it a happy birthday? and the scandal of empty cradles, children shipped to the colonies in the 40s, 50s and 60s. We talked to the woman who uncovered Britain's shameful secret. And you on the phone, your views please on 071-973-9733 or 071-603-1152.
From October the 5th, will you be listening in black and white or colour?
The world's a smaller place. You need the news like never before. I'm Michael Wilson. Keep up with the latest on London News 97.3 FM with me from 6 a.m. Monday to Friday.
And with me, Sharon Doughty. Don't get up in the morning with anything less than a full picture of what's happening in the world and why it matters to you.
The whole spectrum of news and information as it happens.
The most complete travel picture and unrivaled weather forecasts.
The programme, The Balanced Breakfast.
London News, 97.3 FM. All news, all the time.
Europe is still in a state of shock this weekend after more than 900 people died in the Estonia ferry tragedy on Wednesday. Exact numbers of those killed when the Estonia capsized can't even be given until the wreck of the ship is recovered. But bad weather has stopped the search vessel putting to sea until today.